This is the KPTC Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with acclaimed journalist Dar Jamail about the relationship between the COVID-19 pandemic and the climate crisis. And then we talk with OLECAP's new executive director, Cherish Cronmiller, about how the Olympic Peninsula's primary social service agency is coping with the crisis as the virus spreads and the economy shrinks. So now let's go inside the Compass. The COVID-19 pandemic is a dark cloud hanging heavy over the entire planet. But as the saying goes, even the darkest cloud has its silver lining. And over the past week, I've heard people listing several: more time at home to work in the garden, or start long postponed projects, canceled jury duty, connecting socially with friends while keeping at a safe physical distance, and doing things to strengthen the community ties people know they're going to need to rely upon in what seems likely to be a long haul. But perhaps the brightest silver lining is that the pandemic has accomplished something years of hand-wringing and alarm bell ringing by climatologists have not over another crisis, that of disastrous global climate disruption. Practically overnight, humanity's carbon footprint has plummeted as air travel has all but halted, cruise ships have been mothballed, and much of the world's entire economy has ground to a near standstill. If you think the climate crisis is not as serious a threat as COVID-19, you probably have not read journalist Dar Jamail's terrifying book, The End of Ice, cited by the Smithsonian as one of the top 10 science books of 2019. In the book, Jamail examines from close up collapsing ecosystems around the world and makes a resounding case that it probably is far too late to stave off disaster by good behavior. But if emergency measures were to be taken, they might look a lot like what is happening now to deal with COVID-19. After writing the book, Jamail stepped back from journalism and, with his good friend and longtime editor Barbara Cecil, is co-authoring a kind of advice column for life during climate collapse called How Then Shall We Live?, a title they explain in the first installment thusly. It is for those, given all that is collapsing, are risking treasured images of the future and venturing into conversations about adaptation rather than just mitigation. It is for those who are tiptoeing into the unthinkable with a question on their lips: how then shall we live? Even though Jamail lives in Port Townsend, I caught up with him by phone so we could both heed the caution to stay home and minimize contact, as will be the practice of Compass producers for the foreseeable future. Last week I was reading the Business Times, and there was an article in there about how poorly Boeing is faring in this time of crisis here. And there was a comment in there from President Trump saying, "We've got to protect Boeing." And that just, it set me to thinking, because I've been sort of pondering the fact that this pandemic has accomplished something that years of alarms about, like the climate crisis, never came close to accomplishing, which is that air traffic worldwide, although it hasn't come to a complete halt, has really nearly stopped. And cruise ships are at anchor, and I can't even fathom how much the world's fossil footprint has gone down in the last week. So I wonder what your reflections are on that.
That's a very interesting parallel, or rather paradox, or even contradiction between this reaction to this global pandemic and a similar reaction that should have happened years ago regarding the climate crisis. And I think part of it is misinformation, disinformation, lack of information by the majority of the media about how severe the climate crisis already is. That's why I wrote my most recent book, to try to bring that into people's awareness by going to the front lines and just showing them, and a lot of my other reporting. And I think that because of a lack of a broader platform for that kind of information getting out to people, coupled with the disinformation, a lot of it from the IPCC itself, that, oh, there was still time to turn it around and this kind of thing, and a lot of leading advocates and activists spreading that information and giving people, I think, sort of a false sense of hope. And coupled with, I think, then a lack of imagination that if we can't look out our doors right here and see and watch glaciers vanishing in front of our faces and temperatures abnormally warm on a consistent basis, shifting rainfall patterns, everything that's happening right now, and then just think, we know this is only going to get worse because that's what the scientists are telling us. And a lack of imagination to then behave accordingly, given that the entire planet is at stake. Conversely, with COVID-19, we see, you know, people understand, look, I could go out and have contact with someone right now in Port Townsend and get a virus that could well kill me. And it doesn't matter how old I am. It doesn't matter what sex I am. It doesn't matter if I have pre-existing conditions. Yes, there's others that are more likely to die from it than younger folks without pre-existing conditions. But all the data coming out, especially of New York right now, shows us that any of us could die from this if you get it. And so that, therefore, it's a lot easier to have this visceral, all hands on deck kind of a response. And we are going to behave accordingly with this crisis, which is the opposite of how we responded to the climate crisis.
You know, just today, the Senate has passed a $2 trillion care package for America that includes some $500 billion, a lot of which it sounds like will be aimed to rescue the airline industry. And, you know, I mean, and I think that there's a general tendency right now to be hoping, as our president does, for an early return to business as usual, which strikes me as being, you know, perhaps quite short-sighted.
You're being so diplomatic, Steve. On Wednesday of this week, the director of the UN's environmental program, Inger Andersen, said, look, previous warnings we've given, i.e. whether we're talking about the Ebola epidemic of 2014 or the SARS outbreak from 2002-2003 or MERS in 2012, have gone unheeded. And she said that because she said, we have so many existing pathogens that now are capable of passing directly from the wild to domestic animals to people, i.e. this is exactly what happened with COVID-19. And because specifically of habitat destruction from global capitalism via deforestation, mining, exploiting animals for profit, and the climate crisis, all of those things happening are causing this dramatic biodiversity loss and encroachment into places and exposing humans to pathogens that we've never been exposed to before, and able, you know, putting ourselves in a position because of global capitalism where something exactly like COVID-19 was bound to happen. And scientists and epidemiologists have been warning us about this for years. And it's because of the system of global capitalism, which is bent upon eternal expansion, which is impossible in a finite space. Hence, here we are with a pandemic. We already know there's going to be more, and those in the future are going to be even worse, because that's what science is telling us. And so let's take that system that's causing this crisis and this exposure of humans to these pathogens then that would lead to pandemics, and let's dump $2 trillion more into it to keep it going at all costs, damn the consequences. If that's not insane, and if that's not extremely dangerous to us, I don't know what is. And I think that's how we have to really, we have to frame it accurately for what it is, that it's that very system that they're dumping $2 trillion into that caused this crisis. But this federal government and others around the world are bent on continuing it no matter what, and that's another parallel with the climate crisis.
So I have to admit, though, that as I've been looking at this, it's hard to know where we turn at this point. I mean, in the last week, millions of people have been thrown out of work. Most of the ones being thrown out of work are people who literally live from paycheck to paycheck. They're on the brink of
I don't know, desperation, starvation. How do you think we should address this?
Well, it's really, it's two conversations. I mean, we're sitting here talking right. in lockdown, and this is right. a lockdown that's going to continue for yep. weeks, and it should. If we have any hope yep. of slowing the spread of this thing, the idea is long since. That train left the station weeks ago, thanks to this federal administration, so-called administration. But we're in lockdown. So the first part is, you know, we have to be as safe as possible to not put ourselves in positions where either we ourselves are spreading it if we already have it or making ourselves susceptible to it. On the back end of this, whatever is left of this country comes back into this. And I do see us as catastrophic situation of this country because there isn't wide-scale going on in Germany. Maybe able to get a handle on it and figure out where the clusters are and isolate them. None of that's happening here. We literally have nurses wearing hefty bags for PPE in major New York City hospitals. We already have refrigerator trucks outside of hospitals as makeshift morgues for the bodies that are already starting to pile up. And we're still 1 to 3 weeks away from the peak of this thing, depending on where you are in the country. So we have to understand that there's going to be, conservatively, and I'm just quoting other scientists and epidemiologists, at a minimum, 1 to 1.5 million dead Americans on the back end of this first wave, possibly 2, 3, 4, 5 times that amount. So that's what we're in. But when we talk about then where do we go from here after we come out of this, whenever that is, it's a complete restructuring of the economy that, you know, this system has failed. This is end stage global capitalism. And yeah, there might be a couple of more hiccups where they're able to, you know, generate enough fake money and pump it into the system and keep this beast trundling along for another couple of years or something, but this is the end stage of the global capitalism project. And how we are all living right now, being at home, reaching out to our neighbors, how can we support each other in this community? How can we grow more of our own food? We're not going to be getting on airplanes. We're not going anywhere else. We're keeping it local, and we're taking care of ourselves, and we're taking care of each other. This is how we always should have been living anyway. And that's the silver lining to this crisis is now we're being forced to live the right way. So when we do start coming out of this more broadly as a country, I think the only sane response is, okay, well, the silver lining gift of this virus to us is it's given us a taste and an example of this is how we're going to need to get by. And it just happens to coincide with this is the best thing to do for the climate crisis right now as well. This full-scale, deep reduction of CO2 emissions, only putting money into emergency services and very, very basic infrastructures to keep people fed, watered, alive, and well.
I've been speaking with award-winning journalist Dar Jamail. Jamail's final admonition inspired me to phone Olympic Community Action Program's new executive director, Cherish Cronmiller, who took the reins of the Olympic Peninsula's primary social service agency just as the pandemic was arriving in Washington State, and immediately found herself dealing with what promises to be the biggest crisis in the organization's history. We started our discussion talking about her top priority, finding safe haven where the homeless can shelter in isolation from one another, with a particularly urgent need to relocate the 20-plus men and women who have been living in close quarters in the shelter located in the basement of Port Townsend's American Legion Hall before the virus can arrive and spread among them. I knew from an interview Cronmiller had given to KPTZ's Tossed Salad host Phil Andrus last week that the search for a location was on, so I asked how it was going.
We have a top option that would be, you know, our preferred option, but a secondary option would be like hotel rooms, essentially. Yeah. And I mean, I can tell you, I mean, I'm hoping we're less than a week away from, you know, having something finalized, a plan put together. Because what that means is that emergency management would be able to assist with handling some of those costs, especially because, you know, we have to consider other issues potentially at hand, too. You know, what if, God forbid, the hospital gets filled, right? And
right.
We have to find another place for quarantining. What if, people get released from the hospital, and maybe they're not homeless, but maybe they can't go home because it's too dangerous for them to be near, you know, a loved one that, you know, and or a roommate that somehow is immunocompromised. So trying to make plans for all those various persons. I mean, we know that there's some other people currently, you know, out on the street who don't feel comfortable going into the Legion. We want to be able to help those individuals sort of get out of the community as well, right? Because we're all trying to minimize how much we're out in the community. And, you know, where transient people usually go to get Wi-Fi, get in and out of the cold, you know, they go to the library, they go to coffee shops, they go to restaurants. And so, yeah, we want to do our best to, you know, make sure that we're not only keeping those people safe, but we're keeping the community and our staff, you know, medical professionals, everyone as safe as possible.
So no volunteers are going down into the shelter now, are they? There's no meals
being... We still have some volunteers, okay. You know, that have been coming. So I did a call for volunteers to help with that monitoring because, one, we don't really have enough staffing to man the upstairs and downstairs, so we mostly just use the upstairs for sleeping. But, you know, there's not good airflow down there. There's not windows to open. And it's too small of a space for what's now 23 people in there currently.
So about half of them have been moved upstairs. Is that what's happened?
Yeah.
They put cots in the lobby area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, and we covered up the flooring and everything because the Legion had just redone the flooring not too long ago, and we wanted to make sure nothing happened with that. But it's not a, you know, that's not a potential long-term solution. And, you know, saying long term, right, maybe, you know, 30 days, or if you think that somebody starts to have symptoms, right, they not only need to get through that symptomatic period, but then, you know, self-quarantine for, like, you know, another 2 weeks.
Well, no, so, I gather from your interview with Phil, there was the whole place was quarantined because somebody was suspected to have it, but then that quarantine was lifted a few days later, so I gather they tested negative. Is that what happened?
Correct. I see.
Yeah,
so we had a monitor that had a potential exposure. He ended up testing negative, but as soon as we found out about that exposure, you know, we went on essentially lockdown. So if you came in, you know,
you couldn't go out.
You weren't going back out. you had to stay on ground. You know, and we were trying to do that, and that's, you know, that can be really difficult to explain to individuals that maybe have, you know, mental health issues, substance abuse issues, trauma. You know, being confined to a space, especially a space that small, is not pleasant for anyone, right? You see how much people are going stir crazy in their own homes. Well, you know, imagine being in that Legion basement, you know? So when we could release people, you know, they were happy to maybe be able to step outside, but then they very quickly realized, well, everything's closed. You know, whatever their usual routine was to take the bus somewhere or go to the library, you know, or congregate, you know, somewhere at a store, you know, something like that, none of that was available. So then they said, well, you know, please keep the shelter open 24/7, which is fine, but presents, yeah, issues with staffing and monitoring.
Well, and finances, right?
Yeah, finances. So, you know, we have that call for volunteer assistance form, you know, off of our webpage. So it's like a Google form, and people have filled it out saying that they're willing to help us out by volunteering. And so, you know, anyone that was willing to be a shelter monitor in Port Townsend, you know, we put out a, you know, an email to all those folks and said, hey, you know, we need monitors, but you have to feel comfortable going into this environment, and, you know, you have to be very patient. Our goal was we really wanted to try to get volunteers that didn't fit into the vulnerable population. So we wanted more people under 60, ideally under 50, you know, no, you know, health issues.
Right.
You know, that would be comfortable in that environment. And we didn't want to have to anyone to feel forced, you know, so if you didn't feel comfortable going into that environment, we didn't want that. But, you know, a lot of the Coast volunteers
are elderly.
Are older.
Yeah.
And we're elderly. and so, you know, can't potentially have that risk. And when we move individuals, there will be other volunteer opportunities where there's less interaction potentially with, you know, individuals in isolation, anticipating, you know, laundry and, you know, sorting donations, and, you know, different things like that. You know, we certainly appreciate everyone that wants to help, but, you know, we also want to make sure that, you know, we're thinking about the safety of everyone who's been willing to help as well. So, and that's why we moved to the food from the hospital too, right? We didn't want people having to, you know, be down there and prepare and dishes and, you know, everything else. So, you know, so tried to come up with a solution.
So the hospital has been supplying the food for the last couple of weeks? Is the hospital footing the bill for that, or
no? No, we are.
Holy cap!
Don't get me wrong; they gave a good price to us, but it adds up very quickly. So,
is there a cushion in your budget to handle this? I mean, you've got a rainy day fund for this kind of thing?
No. We will have to use the emergency, the COVID funds, essentially for this. Between that and then any disaster funds we can get to help with that increased cost.
To sum up then, the goal is to actually move everybody out of there as soon as a new location can be found for them, it sounds like.
And yes. We know that there's also a need for like a teen drop-in center. So we may convert that space in the interim to a place where, you know, teens could go during the day, and we'll find out whether or not they need night shelter. We don't have reason to believe at this time they need night shelter, but, you know, they essentially don't have a good place to be, you know, throughout the day. And so that's what might happen with that space in the interim.
And that of course, also would create its own sort of monitoring issues, because I can't imagine that the American Legion would be too happy to just have a bunch of teenagers in there unchaperoned.
Right. No. We would have staff staffing for that as well. So,
is there any other message you would like to get out there?
No, I don't have, you know, besides that, you know, if people are in need, you know, they definitely should go to our website, and right on the main page there is a form to fill out if people are in need of help. And so we encourage people to fill out that form. Right now we're, you know, able to get back to people in about, you know, less than 48 hours for their requests for assistance. And if you're interested in wanting to help out, I mean, you can fill out for the volunteer form, or you want to give, you know, $20 to helping us pay rent for people, utilities, meals, food that we're sending, you know, to people, hooking up internet so that students can have internet at home, or if somebody potentially has the option of working at home, you know, helping facilitate that. So we're just trying to be there and be supportive.
Has there been a notable surge in demand for your services?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so the request for assistance, yeah, I mean, it's ramped up. Today has been a little slower, but we at least usually get, like, we're averaging about a request an hour. And so, you know, and a lot of those, you know, are food. They need a box of food delivered, propane, utility, fuel pellets, or there's an issue with water and sewer, right? You know, wanting to help in those ways. A lot of them are food. And then we have a couple people that, you know, are in isolation. They're older. They don't know how to order groceries online. And they essentially need somebody to, you know, to go pick up groceries for them, you know, and maybe a prescription or something. So,
are you working with the food bank on some of these?
Well, only if somebody can potentially go and drive, you know, to the food bank. What we're seeing here is they can't. They need the box of food delivered.
I see.
Or they need the, you know, frozen meals delivered, because we do home delivered meals. You know, we help with the supply chain with food banks. You know, we usually do congregate meals. So, so we've been putting together sort of other shelf stable, you know, type meal boxes to be able to take. And we got some through Food Lifeline. You know, so working to make sure that we can, you know, get out those deliveries, you know, to those people that need it. But yeah, most of our requests for assistance is these people don't have the means to come and pick it up.
You're basically brand new to this job, and this is like, you know.
Yeah, well, but less than a year ago, I was dealing with the tornadoes in Dayton, so I feel like I'm doing some of the same things. It's deja vu, you know, setting up requests for assistance and people that need, you know, food and, you know, people that need some type of, you know, utility or rent assistance, you know, people that, you know, don't know where they're going to potentially live or go, especially if somebody else in the household is sick. You know, people that need car repairs. So very, very similar thing. And then, you know, coordinating with emergency management and, you know, working together, you know, with our partners too, and just trying to make sure that, you know, we're helping those individuals need in the community. You know, that's what we're here for.
So how does your coordination with emergency management work? Are you, like, in constant contact with Willie Bentz or?
Yeah. So I sit in on the phone calls. And, you know, we've been part of not only helping with volunteer coordination, but also helping with setting up the isolation and quarantining sheltering piece. Not only here, but also in Clallam County. In a pandemic like this, for the people that don't have emergency resources, emergency assets, you know, and don't have reserves to fall back on, those are the ones that, in this type of disaster, often need the most help, right? Whereas in a natural disaster, that, God forbid, can hit everyone sort of the same way, you know? It crosses socioeconomic lines. Here, you know, your socioeconomic situation really has a tremendous impact on how well isolation is going for you.
So one more time, let's put out information about how OLECAP can be reached and people can reach out for these services.
Yeah, so one of the easiest ways is just to, if you have internet access, olecap.org, and right on there are the links to if you need assistance or want to volunteer or donate. If you're not able to go online and do that, then just call you know, one of our offices. So the office here in Port Townsend at 360-385-2571. And one of our staff members, you know, will answer the phone. And they can fill out the request for assistance form over the phone with you.
With OLECAP Executive Director Cherish Cronmiller and award-winning climate writer Dar Jamail, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans. We'll be right back.